Shrink Wrap Radio number 278, The Use of Active Imagination in Jungian Sand Play with Dr. Maria Hess.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Maria Hess, PhD, has been a practicing depth-oriented psychotherapist and therapist educator in Sonoma County, California, for over 25 years. She was the founding clinical director and supervisor for the Lomi Community Clinic and for Humanidad Counseling Services. An associate professor of psychology at Sonoma State University, Maria teaches clinical courses to prepare undergrads for advanced training as professional helpers, such as psychologists, marriage and family therapists, and clinical social workers. Her own clinical training is grounded in psychodynamic, somatic, humanistic, and transpersonal modalities. In 2006, Maria was inspired by a workshop that included Martin Kalf, PhD, the son of the founder of Sand Play Therapy. Over the last 5 years, she has studied and implemented sand play in her undergraduate courses, in training, in clinical settings, and in her own psychotherapy practice. This June and July, she traveled to Zurich to study with Martin Kalf more intensively. She has returned from her travels once again, inspired about sand play as well as other nonverbal expressive modalities. This is Maria's third appearance on Shrink Wrap Radio. She has previously appeared on episodes number 20, Teaching with Passion, and number 46, The Narcissistic Personality. Now here's the interview. Dr. Maria Hess, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, David.
I think this is your third time, if I recall.
It is.
Yeah, that's great. Now, you've just returned from the Jung Institute in Zurich, Switzerland. And before we get into what you were doing there, I've been to Switzerland once or twice, but unfortunately never went to the Mecca of the Jung Institute. Mm-hmm. What's that like?
Mm-hmm. It was pretty amazing, actually.
No, what's the building like?
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's right on Lake Zurich, which is a really large, beautiful lake.
Okay.
And it has a boat dock and the whole nine yards. In the center, it has a lovely rose garden that apparently has been there for forever. They're really old bushes, and they've kind of put like symbolic architecture and symbolic like statuary and things like that in the rose garden.
Okay, is it in some kind of an old mansion or something? That's how I imagine it.
It is. Counting the basement and the attic, it has like four different levels.
Okay,
and it's an old building. I mean, it's an old family housing. It's been there a long time.
Wow. Was it in the Jung family, do you know?
Yes, it has been in the Jung family, if I remember correctly. And it's the house that is talked about in the books when he talks about looking across the lake, and that's the place.
Oh, okay, that's the place.
Yeah.
So what were you doing there?
Well, I actually went to the Jung Institute as an adjunct to what I visiting with Martin Kalf, who I was there to study with for sand play. So while I was there, they had the American summer lectures, which are done in English.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, I shouldn't say American. It's more English.
English speakers,
and they came from everywhere. And most of their teachers, however, were from United States and from the San Francisco Institute and someplace in Houston, and so that was interesting. And I just went to a few, like maybe six or seven lectures while I was there.
Okay. So primarily you went there to study with Martin Kauf.
I did.
Who is the leading living exponent, teacher, guru of sand play.
Yes, that's true. Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, I know that you're not a Jungian analyst.
That's right.
Or you don't even bill yourself as a Jungian therapist.
True.
But rather you're a very eclectic, depth-oriented psychotherapist.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Jungian perspective is something that supplements your work. Is that right?
That would be fair to say, yeah, really. However, you know, right now it is taking up my biggest interest.
Yeah.
It is, because there's something about this non-directive Jungian focus that's interesting to me.
Yeah, and just so listeners will know, because I know there are a number of therapists and would-be therapists who listen, you have strong roots in a number of approaches, including Gestalt therapy and somatic approaches.
Mm-hmm.
And
psychodynamic.
And psychodynamic,
yes.
That's the word I was reaching for.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is it that, for how many years have you been practicing now?
30
years, okay. Mm-hmm. So good. So, you know, you're kind of a typical, in a way, of a therapist who has a lot of depth and has checked out a lot of different perspectives. And so I really think your experience and insights will be useful to people to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe you touched on this, but let me ask you again, what is it that's drawing you to the Jungian perspective?
Mm-hmm. Well, what really drew me to the Jungian perspective was my experience with Martin Kauf about 5 years ago and the sand play.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really realize that sand play is funded by three branches of thought. One of them is Jungian psychology, the other is Buddhist psychology, and then the third is a field of sand play therapy that was developed by a woman by the name of Margaret Lowenfeld, who practiced in Britain at the time. So it was this combination of the Buddhist and the Jungian that really showed up for me when I went to a workshop with Marion Woodman, Jack Kornfield, and Martin Kauf. And Martin Kauf was a non-person to me. I had no idea what sand play was or who the Kaufs were. I went to see Jack Kornfield and Marion Woodman.
Yeah, yeah.
But out of it came this incredible gem of a field known as sand play.
And Marion Woodman is a Jungian analyst.
She
right?
is, yeah. She's fabulous.
I would like to interview her.
Yes, I'm sure you would.
Yeah.
She's
if
wonderful.
That's possible.
She's in Canada.
I'll see if I can chase her down.
Yeah, really.
So what is it about sand play in particular that's drawn you to this practice?
Well, there's a couple of things. I think that, and the things that have drawn me to sand play are also, in thinking about it, preparing for this, there's really this kernel for me of all of the modalities that I appreciate are more non-directive, with the exception, of course, of Gestalt and some somatic techniques. But most of it is person-centered, right? It comes from the client.
Okay.
So in sand play, there is that dynamic as well, even though where the Jungian influence, we're going to look at, you know, if complexes show up or archetypes or what the symbols and the signals might mean. But really what we're paying attention to is how it's generated by the client. So there's something about that that really is intriguing to me, is the client becomes the vehicle, the vessel for whatever then needs to play out. And like a dream, right? In our dream group, we talk about if that was my dream. Well, here, what we're really looking at is like a dream, in the sand manifests these kind of arrows that kind of signal what's going on in the person's psyche or in their unconscious or their subconscious. And there's something very exciting about seeing then from this non-verbal, non-directive way, what shows up in these images in the sand.
What I'm hearing is that this non-directive aspect somehow aligns with a deep value of yours.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm much more interested in hearing how the client thinks, what the client feels, what the client understands, than hearing what I think they should do about it all.
Yeah.
For me, after 30 years, I've seen the value of really getting quieter and waiting to see what manifests from the client. I've really seen the value of that.
Getting quieter. That sounds like that might take some discipline, at
it
least
does.
Initially.
Oh, and particularly for somebody like me who just loves to yak it up. It's been a discipline, absolutely.
Yeah.
First doing my own work and really learning how to appreciate my own quietude, mm-hmm. and then how it plays out. But then allowing it to transfer over and then be appreciative of how my clients might manifest that as well.
Now, you've been studying Buddhism as well. Has that fed into this orientation?
Oh, sure. And I would say that's a big chunk of what I really studied with Martin, is how to use the meditative quiet as like the breeding ground for the work of the therapeutic hour. Mm-hmm. So just allowing the quiet to be and then to see what shows up.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very similar to meditation, right? Is that, and then in meditation, you allow whatever comes up to come up, but we're not moving into an analysis or any kind of pulling apart necessarily, mm-hmm. but just more breathing through and allowing. And then we can go back and analyze and look, of course, but in the psychotherapeutic hour, to really allow the quiet to come up, and then the analysis comes if the client is wanting and ready to analyze.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something about that overlay between Buddhism and shamanism. And, I mean, there's all kinds of ways that it merges.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Is anxiety an issue in the quietude? I mean, I could imagine that either you as a therapist might begin to have rising anxiety of, ooh, it's been quiet a long time here, am I supposed to be doing something? Or that the client might have a similar voice coming up.
I think, yeah. I mean, right now I'm paying attention to how the client experiences mm-hmm. it. Because I'm in that grace period, you know, from having just now come out of a two-month training and still not in the hurry and the rush of life yet. So I'm not feeling so much internal anxiety right now, but I am aware of how the anxiety can mount in the therapeutic interchange if you're waiting for something to
mm-hmm,
happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's more less that way if it's more organic, you know.
Well, I imagine that the anxiety for you has gotten a lot less as you've settled more into your quietude, as you said.
It's true.
With more experience.
Yes, it's true.
Now, you've been studying with Martin Kauf in Switzerland for a couple of years. And do I recall correctly that he's the son of Dora Kauf? I think we mentioned that, actually. And she was the originator of sand play therapy.
That's right, yeah.
And I know sometimes I get mixed up between sand play and sand tray.
Mm-hmm.
Can you refresh my memory about the difference between those two approaches?
Well, I don't know much about sand tray, except to know that it's a method that's used most frequently with children.
Okay.
But the primary difference is that, as I understand it, sand tray doesn't have the Buddhist psychology or the Jungian theory behind it.
Okay, right. That comes back from my previous interview with Liza Rabbits mm-hmm. in Petaluma, who also does this work, and I know you've studied with her as well. Maybe you can take us through a bit of the history of the development of this approach.
Okay. This is how I understand it. Dora Kauf talks a little bit about it in her book, Sand Play. But how I understand it is that she was a doctor, and in her late 50s, she actually came into some of this awareness. Where she was living at the time was in the Jung world, right? So
okay. A
lot of people, Jung was her neighbor and in that area, because she lives in Zollikon, and she lived in Zollikon, Zurich. So it was very close to where the Jungs lived. She was also important, and she was taken by the Tibetan plight at the time. So if you remember in 1958-59, this is when the Tibetans exiled, left Tibet. So she and many Tibetans went to places where there's high mountains. So Switzerland's a perfect place.
Oh.
Those good old Alps.
Well, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, in Boulder, Colorado, where there's big
yeah.
mountains. And you find Tibetans. Anyway, she was involved and instrumental in bringing quite a few of the lamas over from Tibet. And so the Dalai Lama had been present in her home, and she was very instrumental in bringing them and helping. She was taken by them and started studying Buddhism herself, and then at the same time was integrating her work. And I don't remember exactly if she had been Jung's client or maybe a client of Marie-Louise von Franz, something like that, but she had a connection also for her own personal work of doing that.
Yeah.
And then she had met Margaret Loewenfeld, who also was doing this child therapy. And I should mention that, you know, as I remember, Adora was a pediatrician, so she had a particular affinity with children.
Okay.
So the Loewenfeld model was interesting to her because it was a direct way of working with kids, and she had noticed that there was a lot of children, especially when they're traumatized, who are nonverbal. So she brought those three areas together, her interest in Buddhism, her interest in Jung, and then her awakening and understanding of how Loewenfeld worked on the floor with children, with toys, and would see how their worlds would kind of get laid out in front of her about how, the way the kids played with the toys. So that's kind of how it all kind of emerged.
So it's kind of, it sounds like there's a relation to play therapy.
Well, yes, there is a relationship in that way where play therapy is, as I understand it, and I'm certainly not an expert, but as I understand it, does not have the Buddhist element or the Jungian element of, you know, looking at what that might mean and exploring the complexes or doing the active imagination or other kinds of visualization processes that you would do with sand play.
That's that history is fascinating. I'm glad I asked you about that because when you said earlier, you talked about, well, there's the Jungian influence and the Tibetan influence. Well, I know that you're interested in Tibetan stuff and Tibetan Buddhism, and so I thought, well, maybe that's just kind of your overlay.
No.
But it's not. It's really right there in the history.
It's true. And, you know, Martin, one of the things that he's known for is that he is a translator for the Dalai Lama. So he really became immersed in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and his wife is a Dharma teacher, and Martin leads a meditation retreat. So he has both, you know, his world as a psychologist and then his world as a Buddhist practitioner and teacher.
I love the way everything comes together. I
Isn't
mean, across across all these interviews that I've done now, which are well over 300.
Wow.
And I just see so many connections between everything,
I bet you do. I bet you do.
Yeah.
It's really true.
So, as we move closer to the actual sand play session, what does a sand play session look like, you know, or the fly on the wall?
Yes.
What would the fly see?
Oh, yeah. Wouldn't that be an interesting life?
No, not particularly.
Just to be able to see it all. Well, I'm imagining that like every therapeutic session, it would be different for every person at any given session. But I can tell you that what stays the same is that there is a small box, as you can see here, and it's about 2.5 feet wide, long, and about a foot and a half wide, and about 9 inches deep, and it's blue in the inside and around the corners and edges, and it's filled with sand. And it's usually beach sand, by the way. And most of us have an experience of being with this kind of sand, particularly. And then there are figurines. And it's my experience, both as somebody who does sand play as a client and sand play as a therapist, is that the quality of the figurines really matters. Because these figurines then take on the charge or the personality or the experience, if you will, of whatever is being represented. So it's not just a dragon, but it might be the dragon who was the father who was alcoholic and screamed and yelled. And so that it shows up in the tray as a dragon. But when the client talks about it, it may be representative of something else. And on one day, the dragon might be the fierce voice of the father, and on another day, it might represent a sense of feeling personally empowered and being in charge of one's life for oneself.
So where an outsider might just see a little figurine of either glass or plastic or ceramic of a dragon, as the client gets really engaged and immersed, I gather it's much more than that. It's charged with meaning and develops a kind of life of its own.
Yes, it does. And it can take a long time also to understand what it is, because this is a non-directive, non-verbal thing. So it's not necessarily like the client completes a tray and then we sit down and talk about what that tray means. Sometimes it will go unaddressed. We won't say anything more. The client will move away from the tray and I'm going to listen to how their most recent dating experience was, and we're not going to talk about that tray. Other times, clients will come in and they're fully charged up with something, and they want to play in the sand for the release, because it's also a wonderful way to release feelings. It's such an expressive modality. Mm-hmm. So there's a way of, you know, like getting it out of the body, if you will, and into the sand, and the sand then holds the charge, and the figurines hold the charge. And sometimes I'm invited to look at that discussion, you know, that the client might have with the figurines themselves, or maybe between the figurines.
Okay.
So in some way, you know, that's an exciting part, because it looks a little gestalt-y, you know, that there's this discussion that can happen between the figurines,
right,
or between me and the client about the figurines.
Yeah.
So it's where I see the fields of theory starting to link over and lap over too.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine that the client might choose a dragon and maybe in that session not even know that it's about their father or about something else.
That's right.
So there's not a conscious process of saying, oh, this dragon will be my father.
That's right. Sometimes it's a surprise to the client.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, wow. And I do not participate in this. So I'm not playing in the sand. I'm not suggesting anything. I mean, this is non-directive.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting off to the side. I'm observing. I'm participating. I'm not telling them, oh, that dragon would be good there. Or, don't forget this over here. I'm pretty non-verbal. I'm over here. And there's not a whole lot of direction that goes on, or even an initiation. As I've brought in my own sand tray and my own figurines, it depends totally on the client. So I have some clients, I don't think they've even recognized that I have the tray in the office yet.
Yeah.
So, but there's others that are like, okay, so what's this all about? And so there's different ways that people approach the tray.
Yeah.
And so,
well, what would your instructions typically be for somebody's first tray?
Well, it might be something, a client says, hey, can I play with that? And I say, sure, and take the lid off.
An adult
client.
Mm-hmm.
And I just take the lid off and open the windows on my bookcase, and that's how I introduce it.
Yeah, the bookcase, which I'm looking at, I'm actually physically present with Maria. Most of my interviews are conducted over Skype, but it's wonderful when I can be with the interviewee. And so I'm looking at this bookcase. It's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 shelves with glass doors. So when you open the glass door, and you can see actually through the glass doors, of course, and there are, so there's 6 shelves full of figurines, and then I see a bunch of figurines or figures on top of the tray itself, which right now is closed, and then I see boxes underneath.
It's
so
true.
I think you've got quite a collection going
on.
Yes,
it's really quite a small collection, actually, but yes, you can see it. You can get a sense of how many figurines are really essential for.
But getting back to your instructions to the client, I imagine sometimes, at least, you must give them some orientation of what their job is in relation to the sand tray.
Well, you know, it's my style to be very limited.
Okay.
So I say something like, take your time and, you know, do whatever you'd like in that space. I mean, really, it's like that. I don't really say too much. You know, I've not had the experience of clients not knowing what to do.
Mm.
They see the figurines, they see the sand, and it's connect the dots.
Wow. It sounds like it connects with the inner child.
It really does.
And that we're just at some intuitive level, we're just drawn to it.
I think so. And I think so many of us have the experience of, when you have a mound of sand in front of you, what you do is play.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember as a kid, right, having a bucket and a spoon and being in heaven for hours.
Right. Going to the beach and building sandcastles.
Totally. Or being on the riverbed. Absolutely.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time playing in a. My grandparents had a cabin in the San Bernardino Mountains, and there was a creek there. Oh, I spent hours and hours and days building dams and forts and
Absolutely. Things
like that.
Yes, that's kind of thing it is. You bet.
So, say a little bit more about the role of the therapist in the process.
Mm-hmm.
We know you're hanging back, mm-hmm. but you do have to go out and get all this training.
That's right.
What is it you're learning about what you're supposed to do?
Well, you know, what I'm learning is in this aspect of sound play, right, the Jungian aspect, so part of my job is being familiar with the fairy tales and with the energies of the archetypes and being clearer and clearer about what a complex is and feels like. And, you know, I'm no expert, but I'm certainly getting a sense of what that's like or when a complex shows up. And mostly I'm connecting the dots in my psyche. So I'm remembering the discussions that I've had with the client, the stories that they've told, the places where their hurt resides. And sometimes I look at the tray and it just looks like, oh, wow, look at this, you know, the energy of that dominant, restrictive mother is showing up, and it's looking like it might be embodied in this figurine today and here. I'm not really sharing this with the client. It's more what I'm doing in my notes. And then I take pictures of the trays, and I send them to the clients. So then they receive the photographs of the trays, and then sometimes the client talks about what they saw in the photograph, other times they don't, but I keep a record, a photographic record also of the trays, and when I look at a client case, I can start seeing how things show up for the client, at least as I understand them, and I might lay that before them at some point in the therapy.
Do you see a progression in these pictures of the trays over time? Do you see any kind of progression that mirrors, hopefully, a healing process?
Oh, absolutely. And I've had the experience myself. So I really can't speak for the client's internal dialogue yet because I haven't really heard much what they're thinking about what they're doing with their trays. But I know for myself, I've been doing it for about 18 months just as a practice for myself. And there's a couple of things that I've noticed and that I feel like issues are resolved without having talked about them.
Mm-hmm.
So, like feeling a nervousness around my teaching practice, for example.
Okay.
And noticing that's changed over time as I've continued to work with it. I can't tell you, the person that I work with, she's never interpreted the trays. I don't know that I've ever interpreted to her my trays, but I interpret them to myself when I see the pictures and mm-hmm. I go, oh, look at that, look at that, look at that.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm noticing is that there's a calming that's happening. There's a place inside of myself that I can go back to that feels more reliable and more continuous, and I'm happier. That's a good outcome.
Yeah, right. How does sand tray therapy articulate with Jung's major theoretical concepts such as active imagination, the collective unconscious, the archetypes that you've mentioned, mm-hmm. symbols of transformation, individuation, and so on?
Well, for the very basic ideas that you can look in the trays and you can see images that are trying to work that out, like a black stone and a white stone being placed next to each other and looking like they're there for balance. And the client might say something like, oh, this is a balance piece. So that you can see that they're trying to look for the right and the wrong, the good and the bad of it. You know, so how do things balance out? When negativity shows up in the tray, you know, or something that we might talk about as a complex or a negative manifestation of something in the collective unconscious, that the way the client works out the negativity for themselves. Sometimes there's like, I don't hear much dialogue, but there's noises of play, you know, the explosions, just the elimination of that kind of negativity that can happen in the tray that's so expressive, you know,
well,
like with kids, guns. And
when kids are in the bathtub,
That's right.
You'll hear explosions and if it's a little boy,
yeah,
gunshots and all kinds of things.
Yes.
I remember being embarrassed as late as being in graduate school at the University of Michigan. I think I remember this. And I'm in the bathroom, in the counseling center, where I'm an intern. And I'm doing something like that. And somebody comes in, and suddenly I'm self-conscious. You know, I'm in the stall.
That's right.
I've gotten carried away.
Oh, yes.
I kind of miss that. I don't do that anymore.
That's right. Well,
there's
know.
The tray. She's gesturing towards the tray,
folks. That's right. I got Army guys. And you know, by the way, I just want to let you said little boys at least, but I'll tell you, there's a little boy, little girl in everybody. So the little girls who are these big women also explode things.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yes, absolutely.
So it sounds like there are all these Jungian things really that are manifesting themselves in the sand play work, but not necessarily talked about those abstract
terms. That's what I was going to actually elaborate on, is that in the act, you said something about the act of imagination. I know for myself, most of the act of imagination is happening inside of me, so I'm not really even saying it out loud, but when I'm placing the figurines, I'm having the dialogue, right? And it looks like that's happening with my clients as well, is that they're having a dialogue. I mean, because you can see that there's a delay between placing one figurine and then looking for the other and then placing the other one. So there is a full, it's a fertile void. This is not an empty silence.
It's a fertile void. Some kind of process is unfolding.
Absolutely.
Coming up from within.
Yes, and I think that's part of what the training is about, is learning to trust, especially those of us that have been trained as verbal therapists, right, to trust that there is something valuable and valid happening in the silence, that it's not just dead space, that the psyche really knows what we need on some level and manifests it in the unconscious, and that's part of the play of it.
Yeah, and that trust is really key. I'm going back to your earlier observations about the silence, and that trust is really key. Where does that trust come from? Mm-hmm. How does one develop that trust?
Well, for me, I think it's been a process of a lot of things. One, I also have a 30-year history as an educator, so it's a similar process I see as a teacher, is having to trust that what I've decided to bring into the classroom is what's going to meet the need of that student. And if it doesn't happen out there, they're going to let me know. I have to trust that too, right? So the same way in a psychotherapeutic practice is that, as a matter of experience, learning that in my relationship with the client, I'm going to be able to hear from them and trust them and myself. So I've had to just practice. It's just practice.
Yeah, and experience.
Right,
on both sides of the couch, so to speak.
Absolutely.
As being both a client, having been a client for a long time in various settings, and as a therapist.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I also know, and you know this, David, too, as a psychologist yourself, is that to learn to put one's ego aside to be able to not know and ask. So to say to the client, I'm clueless here. What do you suppose this is about? Takes a particular type of trust to be vulnerable as the quote-unquote healer.
Yes. You and I have been in a dream group together for a number of years, and it seems like there might be an affinity between sand play and the Jungian understanding of dreams. So what do you see as the relationship between the two?
Well, I've used the sand tray itself and the figurines to play out dreams. So it's such a similar thing in some way. The way to see it, as I look at it anyway, is that the tray is kind of a way of working with dreams. And what I learned with Martin this last time is that I came upon this notion of looking at all of life as if it's a giant sand play. Right, so I'm a figurine and I'm walking around in a sea of figurines and everything that's happening is happening in this tray.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, yeah, it's kind of like a dreamscape, right? Because when you're in it, especially if you're lucid dreaming, you realize, oh, yeah, this is just totally a dream. I can do whatever I want in it.
Well, this is reminding me that the lucid dreamers, the people who are really into the lucid dreaming, have been writing and arguing that one should realize in the midst of everyday life that they are in a lucid dream.
Yes.
That it's a call to wake up.
Yes, I would agree. And I think that, well, see, I personally believe that that's what psychotherapy is anyway. It's like a waking dream. Mm-hmm. And then the box, the play, what happens in the sand play really seems that way to me. Like we're having a dream together. You know, it's kind of like how all in a lot of psychological theories, they talk about how you can't have just the client's experience, because when you're in the psychotherapeutic hour with the person, there's two of us. So my psyche is being affected by my client. My client's psyche is being affected by me. And so in the same way, that's why it's so important in the sound play that the therapist not impose their thinking, because I'm already imposing something just by being there,
yeah.
Right, the psyche. And I think the same thing is true in our dream group. That's why the sensitivity, right, of using Jeremy Taylor's models of if it was my dream, I would, right, is being respectful that the other person has their psyche active and we may not know. And so to be respectful and come in that way. Mm-hmm. And I just really see the parallels between the dream work and the sand play and psychotherapy as being really close together, like mm-hmm. a tripod kind of experience.
Right, right, right. And I suppose I can disclose that there have been times when we got together as a dream group and you didn't have a dream that you called,
yes,
but you brought in one of your sand play pictures,
yes,
or therapy.
That's right. It's such an interesting thing, too, to also see that, for me anyway, these last couple of years, the more I've been doing the sand play work, as you know, my dream life went down to not being able to remember. I mean, I think in the last 2 years, I've remembered 5 dreams.
Mm.
And I'm pretty convinced that there's a correlate, anyway, that when I do the sand play, a lot of my dreaming energy gets manifest actually in the trays. Because when I went to Switzerland and I was there for 2 months and I didn't do sand tray. Okay, so I didn't do any sand play work while I was there.
You didn't?
No.
I thought that's totally what you were
doing.
No,
I went there to study. And I did. I studied it, but I didn't play.
Uh-huh.
But my dreams came back. So I remembered more of my dreams when I wasn't doing my sound.
Wow.
Now, that's how it went for me. You know, lots of people have both. Lucky them. Their dreams and their sound play.
Yeah.
But for me, it was the dreams went in the background as the work and the sound play came into the foreground.
Well, that's fascinating because being the psychodynamically oriented people that we are, we really think our dreams are there for a purpose to get us to pay attention to underlying feelings, emotions, situations that need to be looked at, experienced, examined in some way.
Yeah.
And so it really makes sense what you're saying, that if you're getting that stuff out there in the tray, then you don't need to remember the dream.
Yeah. And when I was in with Martin, part of the thing that was very interesting is that because we weren't working with the tray, what we got really interested in were the images that would come up in my sessions with him. So we would have 3-hour-long sessions at a time. So I hired him privately, and I studied with him privately, and I would meet with him somewhere between 6 and 9 hours a week. And they were it was structured around a supervisory consultation experience. So
okay.
I wasn't his client there. I was a private student. And so we had lots of conversations. And because we weren't working with the sand tray per se, we started getting curious in just the images that would come up for me. And normally, I would maybe go to the great God Google and find an image and print it and then work with it, maybe in a collage or other kind of expressive modality. But I didn't have access to a printer.
And I was in a very interesting situation there, in retreat, didn't understand the language, in a very small room in a pension. So it was very intensive and very specific, and I had lots of time in between my sessions with Martin to just deepen my work. Mm. And part of what we decided to do together was, I see it was very client-centered in some way, what we decided to do together was to work with my images as they came up. So without the printer, I did art. So the image would come up, and then I would draw them rather than print them.
Well, how would these images come up? If you're, I'm imagining you're in conversation.
That's right, in conversation, and then meditation. Martin would say, what just came up for you? Oh, I don't know. I'm feeling a little uncomfortable. Let's get quiet. Let's go see. And then we'd go into meditation together, and an image would arise. For example, I felt embarrassed about being tearful. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm here to talk with you about how to move my professional life ahead. I don't want to be crying. I have this issue. I don't want to be so emotional.
Right.
And he's like, wow, you know, you're crying. Why don't we just work with what is? So I started getting in touch with being, you know, flowing water. He said something. Oh, it's like flowing water. That's what he said. So I went back and I put into Google flowing water, for example. And what came up was a Tibetan goddess by the name of Sarasvati. And Sarasvati means flowing water. Hmm. So I got really interested in that because Sarasvati is my Dharma name. So it was like this...
So all the synchronicity was happening.
All the synchronicity was happening.
Yeah.
So then I painted a picture of Sarasvati and I brought it back and it became one of my working figurines. So while I was there for 7 weeks, I ended up with like 20 some odd images that I had drawn and cut out. And then I would come to Martin, and we would place them on his rug. Mm-hmm. And he'd say, oh, well, let's pretend it's your body. Where would you feel these images in your body? Mm-hmm. So then I'd create this body of imagery where it would be, oh, this would be in my heart. This would be in my, you know, lower abdomen. This would be in my throat. And I'm like, Martin, your rug is becoming like this giant sand tray. And we're doing sand play in it.
Uh-huh.
And I learned something from that, is that with the images want to come out one way or the other, whether you have them three-dimensional, whether they come up in your imagination, whether they're part of your inner dialogue or not.
Or
it's
a dream.
All there. Or a dream.
Yeah.
Or some kind of a feeling that you get with somebody when you're talking and you're not quite, it's not quite on what you're talking about, but you have a niggle. Why am I feeling this way talking to this person? It's like, it's everywhere in our lives, you know, and I became very sensitive to that. There was something about, you know, everywhere, sand play happening everywhere. World is sand play.
Huh.
It's very powerful.
Yeah, I'm not, except in my dreams, I don't think of myself as a very visual person. I have visual dreams, but in the ordinary course of my day, I don't have these images arising. It sounds like you do.
Well, I did with the agreement that that's what we were going to do. So I was really looking for my images.
Okay.
And I was doing things that was visual in regards to it. So I went to Google looking for images.
Okay.
Or, for example, I went to a workshop that Martin gave while I was there. He gave a workshop with Peter Levine around trauma and healing. One of the things he was talking about was the connection to Buddhism and a concept of Mara, right? The Mara being the destroyer who wanted to keep Buddha away from his enlightenment. And he had images that he was flashing on the screen, and from watching his images, they stimulated other images for me.
Yeah, and also you were in this intense encounter. I'm thinking of alchemy and the beaker.
That's right.
The container.
Yes.
And you're in this container with Martin in this intense space.
Absolutely.
And so that's also causing stuff to bubble up.
Absolutely. And one of the biggest images that came up was a cauldron. So I spent a lot of time drawing this cauldron. And it became like the base of everything that fit in.
Yeah.
So in some way, you know, the samp tray is the cauldron, huh?
Yes, exactly.
The body is the cauldron.
I'm recalling that Jung himself went through a period as an adult, of building little dams and waterworks with stones and pebbles in a nearby stream.
Yes.
It seems like there would be a relationship between what he was doing there and the sand play that later emerged.
Yes, I think that there was a way that Dora was impressed by that and impacted by that. You know, also I want to tell you that while I was in Zurich this last time, the Jungian Institute was celebrating the 50-year anniversary of Jung's death. So I went to go see Jung's home, his childhood home, and I went to see his grave. And they had a big event, and I watched a video of Jung being interviewed. And for the first time, really, I connected with the pain that Jung experienced and talked about in this interview about being such a thinker. And that for him, getting to his feelings was really the point of it all for him. He was really aware of how being such a thinker and not feeling compromised the quality of his life and his unconscious. And so there was a way in this interview he was really talking about, yes, I had to really get to that part of myself that wasn't thinking oriented.
Yeah.
And I really got to see, wow, he struggled with that.
Yeah.
Somehow, I mean, I knew about it, I had read it, but to see him really struggling in the interview was really something.
Maybe you've already touched on this. This was your second trip to Switzerland to study with Martin. What was the new learning for you in the second trip?
Well, for one, it was this experience of seeing how profound working with the imagery was with or without the sand and the figurines. So that was something to just see, to see how the images evoked inside of me that I didn't need the figurines. That was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that, you know, you imagine here, for the last year I've been negotiating this training with Martin, and I had been negotiating with him to bring a set of slides, and then we would analyze the slides together. But he didn't read my email all the way through, and so he didn't want to do that when I got there.
Oh, no.
And we had to change my thinking about what I was there for.
And so you went through some period of disappointment and frustration, it sounds like.
Well, you know, I was ready to be disappointed, but I wasn't disappointed.
No.
No, it was incredible what happened. And just watching him as a therapist and a teacher, how he handled that, I learned so much, is that he was just so open and so, let's just take it from there. Here, we're not going to do this, we're going to do this.
Uh-huh.
And what does this look like between you and I right now?
So he did
really
open it up to invite your reaction.
Absolutely. And he was like, of course, you know, if that's exactly what you want to do, I will, of course, do what you like.
Oh, okay, good.
But what would happen if we just see what would come up between the two of us? And that became very exciting.
It's a much riskier kind of invitation, right?
Yes. And he said it was the first time he had ever done this kind of work with another person.
Uh-huh.
So that was also very exciting to see what we would create together.
So
normally
learning,
he has supervision groups.
Yeah, learning for both of you.
It was. It was a learning for both of us.
Wow.
It was really great.
Wow. Do you see sand play as a complete therapy in itself or more as a supplement to other sorts of therapy? Because it sounds like it's more on the supplement end.
Well, it can be. But I think it, in and of itself, it's a whole therapeutic technique that I think could be very beneficial. How I'm seeing it for myself, and this is my very limited understanding. I mean, you know, 3 years of studying this is nothing. So it's really a drop in the bucket. In my experience, there's just so much to it. There's a lot of depth to this modality. But from my spot as a beginner, for me, it's been inclusive all by itself, but I'm not the best person to. I've had years of therapy, so is it what it is now to me because of everything else that's come before it? And
sure.
Would it be what it is to me now without it?
Well, let's not get all tangled up there.
You see how it can go.
So, you know, speaking of that then, and I think you're very humble to describe yourself as a beginner, and at the same time, you know, I'm willing to believe that, what would be your advice to other therapists who might or might not be new to Jungian ideas, but who'd like to somehow integrate sand play into their work?
There's wonderful books, and there's a training now that's been started. Sand play is now, in the last few years now, going into the certification process, and so there's more classes available on it. There is the American, the International Society of Sand Play Therapists. There's the American Association of Sand Play Therapists. That could give a lot of information, and that's kind of how I started, was by reading what was available online, and then I went to books that were more deliberate.
Are there a couple of books that come to mind as outstanding?
There are, absolutely. Dora Kalf's book, Sand Play. There's also Bradway and McCord's book on Sand Play, the Silent Workshop. And then also Esther Weinrib wrote a remarkable book. We have a local expert here in Cloverdale, Barbara Turner. She wrote the handbook on Sand Play. So it's now, you know, it's like something that's been around for a while, but it's been gaining momentum and nationally and internationally. So there's quite a bit written now about sand play. And there's a journal of sand play therapy that's wonderful.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that it was on the increase.
It is.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we wind down, is there anything that you'd like to add, anything that you were hoping to say, planning to say that we didn't get to?
Yeah, well, you know, now that you mention it, there's only one thing. When you were talking about adjunctive therapy, a couple of years ago, I had been involved in a clinic that was working with a lot of Latino young men who had been they were involved in the legal system.
Okay.
And we were told that Latino guys would never respond to sand play therapy and blah, blah, blah. They don't even like to go to therapy, blah.
They're going to be tough and macho.
Yeah. You know? But we used the sand play model with them, and we had remarkable experiences with them. One, it totally bypassed any kind of language barrier. And we also used therapists that were not bilingual working with Spanish-speaking clients using the sand tray. So it broke down that language thing altogether, because you didn't need to do too much. You could just see it play out in the tray. That was pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
Also, so I guess in some way that was a very successful adjunctive. And then also, you know, I've used sand play in hospice situations, in people's dying process. So I've been at their deathbed using a small miniature sand tray and having them use the figurines while they were in their dying process.
Really?
And that's been remarkable. That was remarkable. So now that was...
How so?
Well, because the client came to recognize through doing the play that they had a death scenario running, that they didn't really realize. They had beliefs about dying and death that they didn't realize until they saw in the tray.
Mm.
That somehow they had demonized death rather than seeing death as a natural progression of life.
Mm-hmm.
So for them, that was very liberating. Oh, no wonder I'm having such a hard time accepting my dying process. I see it as the enemy. That's a pretty big awareness for somebody who might have that block around surrendering to let go. So I guess I wanted to say that, because those were two really profound examples of the power of this work.
Oh, yeah.
I was really touched by both of those scenarios.
Yeah. You know, there was one other thing I meant to ask you about, which was sand play in teaching, because
yes,
I know that you're bringing it into the classroom.
I have, and I've had some of the most remarkable, as a matter of fact, one of the things I really want to write about, I mean, you know, in the list of things that I'd love to write about, right? But one of the things that was really powerful, and I've talked this with my students over and over again, I've taught this class probably for 5 semesters now called the Depth-Oriented Psychotherapies, and in it, they have a sand play experience. They do one sand play, and then they witness one other student's sand play, and then they write about it. And again, we don't analyze their trays. They talk about it if they want to, and then we see what shows up. And what has come out in one tray has been remarkable. One sand play, just one sand play. And how the students see parts of themselves that are so surprising, mm-hmm. so shocking inside themselves. Not shocking like, oh, terrible, yeah. but shocking like, whoa.
Big insight.
Big insights, yeah. you know, about their personal power or that their whole, that something's going on for them that's holding back their personal power, or really seeing that there's a pocket of something that they're trying to get at but they're in denial about. It's like that juxtaposition. How can you move ahead when you've got something holding you back here? So those have been really exciting.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
Well, I think we probably have come to the end of our chat here,
okay.
and I love the passion and energy that you bring to it, and I'm so glad I'm sitting in the same room with you and not
Thanks.
Doing it over Skype.
Yeah,
so
it's been fun.
Yeah, Dr. Maria Hess, thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure, David.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with my friend and colleague, Dr. Maria Hess. I apologize for the fact that the audio was not up to the usual standard. We conducted the interview in Maria's office, and unfortunately, there's quite a bit of room echo. The loss of audio quality, however, is offset, I think, by the energy and spontaneity of our being physically present with each other. In fact, I wish we had a video on this one because Maria was positively radiant, having just returned from Switzerland, and so full of energy and enthusiasm. For any future interviews with her, though, I'm definitely going to seek out a better room. I'm hoping this interview has fairly wide appeal to the many therapists and counselors, both practicing and aspiring, who listen to this show. Maria is a good example of a seasoned therapist who is not a Jungian analyst, but who over the years has evolved a very eclectic practice drawing on a range of theoretical perspectives and trainings. And she has sought out training and supervision in a specific Jungian technique to enrich her own personal life and her professional practice. And I think there are many of you out there who are like that or for whom this approach might be attractive. I'm also impressed that Maria has gone directly to Martin Kalf, the leader in the sand play field, at great personal expense. This is what she does, and I've learned from watching the development of other friends and students who have also sought out the very top exponents in whatever approach they were seeking to learn. In my own development, I never felt that I could afford to make that sort of financial commitment. But I've learned vicariously the value of making the financial sacrifices to study with the very best. I can see that it's paid off in one way or another for all those in my personal sphere who've made that sort of commitment. I'm also proud to say that Maria apprenticed herself to me as a teacher for many years, first assisting and later co-teaching classes on counseling. She's gone on to win awards in teaching excellence, and I'm happy to have played a role in her success and development and to have a place in her pantheon of trusted mentors.
That's right. Shrink Wrap Radio. Coming at you now. Yo, everybody, let's get down. There's a new MC in town. Talking psychology interviews. Dr. Dave is all the rave. Ain't no slouch on the digital couch. He's on the pod. Podcast got the bod. Yeah. You want to be in the know? No. Talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All right.
Hello, my wonderful listener. Thanks for coming back to Shrink Wrap Radio. And if this is your first time by any chance, well, welcome. And also, I'm wondering if I gained any new listeners by my attendance at the Second World Conference on Positive Psychology. At some expense, I ran off about 500 postcard advertisements. I probably left 200 or 300 of them at the conference. And I'm just wondering if they got me any listeners. So I'd love to get an email from you if that's how you happen to be here. By the way, you know that I am blogging for Psychology Today, and I put up a new blog post about the difference between narcissism and self-compassion. And so if you haven't seen it, you might check that out. The best way to find my blog is just to Google The Happiness Dispatch, and that will get you there. I don't know if you remember, sometime back I was talking about, I was kind of trying out for a new podcast network that had expressed interest in my shows and kind of was promising that they could widen my audience and bring in some new sponsors that would kind of increase the income around here. Well, I made a commitment with them to create 6 shows for them and to get some coaching from them. And I was very ambivalent about getting coaching. I was, based on feedback I've received from you all, I felt like I was on the top of my game, and I wasn't sure that a coach would have that much to offer. And they did have some ideas, but I'll tell you, their claim was that I could be more commercial, quotes, more commercial. And they wanted me to have a fast, quicker lead into the shows, so I thought that was a good idea. And so you'll notice I've changed up the beginning somewhat, and I'm trying to get into the actual interview more quickly. So let me know how you feel about that. I think I'm not going to be doing the what I call the billboard with a sound clip before the actual interview, so that'll get me there quickly. I used to think that was pretty slick, but it did add some time. So they wanted me to be more commercial, and a lot of what that came down to was they didn't want me to let my guests run on for so long. Rather, they wanted it to be more conversational, which to my mind meant interrupting my guests and cutting in a lot more often. And I guess that's how, you know, talk radio is on AM radio and so on. But a lot of the positive feedback that I've received from you all has been more about my style of letting the guest have their head, so to speak. So I basically ended up telling that other network to shove it. So there goes that potential career of being more commercial. Hey, I want to thank Liz Beck of Liz Beck Designs for renewing her banner ad on our site. I do hope you'll click on that, particularly if you're a therapist who's looking to have your own website, because that's what she specializes in. She does, I think she can do websites for anybody, but her specialty is creating websites for therapists. So there is a banner in the right-hand sidebar, and I really appreciate her patronizing the site and paying us a monthly fee to have her banner there. And if you've got a business that you'd like to exercise to advertise there, please do let me know. Now, today's interview with Maria Hess about her Jungian sand play training will be part of a upcoming Jungian CE course, a continuing education course for continuing education units. And I'll be putting up the first of 4 courses quite soon. It's not quite ready yet, so I'll let you know as soon as it is. And I want to thank those people who let me know that they could hear my interview with Martin Seligman. I wasn't sure if that you would be able to hear it or not. You may recall that I had planned that today's episode would be a continuation of the keynotes from the Second World Congress on Positive Psychology, and this would have been the keynote by Dr. Richard Davidson from the University of Wisconsin, the eminent brain researcher and meditation researcher. But I've not yet heard back from him giving me permission to use his keynote that I recorded. So I'm still hopeful for the future, and I'll keep you posted. So I know I'm running long here, so I'll cut all the announcements short with this and just say, don't forget the big green donate button. If you have not donated to Shrink Wrap Radio yet, your support would be most welcome.
Hi, I am Oscar.
Hi, I'm Michelle.
Och du lyssnar på Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for that transition, Michelle and Oscar in Sweden. In case you didn't catch the Swedish part, that was, you are listening to Shrink Wrap Radio. I love it. That was one of four sound clips that Michelle sent along with the following note. Hi, David. Here are some vignettes, what I refer to as transitions or clips, that you can use if you'd like. I'm working slowly and methodically to create a fan base for you at school, the psych department at Stockholm University. Progress is slow but steady. Today, I actually sent an email regarding some exam matters to a teacher and also included links to your two podcasts. I still have got approximately 45 episodes before I'm up to date, but I'm getting there. A good friend told me that you read one of my emails on a show. Can you imagine I haven't listened to it yet? I guess I'm a bit stubborn, but I don't want to miss any of your shows. Thank you for your amazing work. You'll hear from me soon again. Sincerely, Michelle. Michelle, thanks so much for doing these transitions along with your friend Oscar and for evangelizing there at Stockholm University, evangelizing Shrink Wrap Radio. I really love your enthusiasm. And Michelle and I have had some correspondence back and forth, and she's really been a strong supporter. How wonderful. Okay, here's another one from Ellen, who writes, Hi, Dr. Dave. I just sent Shrink Wrap Radio a donation for $50, and thanks for all the great listening your podcasts have been, not to mention the skillful guilt motivation you piled on at the end of show number 277. You must know my mother. Oh, well, I'm glad it was effective. And you'll notice I toned it down this time. I won't give a heavy guilt-inducing motivation in every show. Okay, I'll change it up a bit. She goes on to say, I appreciate the variety of guests and topics you present and treat the podcast as a sort of buffet, picking the subjects which fit my mood when I have time to listen. Two of my favorites include The Horse Boy along with Temple Grandin interview, which gave me new insight into minds which think differently from what we consider, quotes, normal, and the rich contributions they can make. Another of my favorites are the conversations you had with your friend Jerry Trumbull. The two of you together are entertaining, and I enjoy following the twists and turns of his thinking. Finally, I want to mention the last two podcasts on the World Congress on Positive Psychology. I could indeed hear the recording of Dr. Seligman's speech and the interviews which followed. Tonight, I finished up the second in the series and found myself wishing I'd been at the conference to see the exhibits and talk with the people. Would it be possible for you to talk a little more about the types of studies people were presenting and any other interesting things you saw? I hope you can put together one more podcast on the conference. In parentheses, she says, regarding happiness, I believe what Abraham Lincoln said, people are about as happy as they make up their minds to be. I wasn't familiar with that quote. Thanks for doing Shrink Wrap Radio, a listener, and that's from Ellen. Ellen, thank you for your generous contribution and also for your generous remarks here. And your suggestions for another show on the World Congress on Positive Psychology, which, as you know, I'm trying to get permission to do the third keynote that I have. So I'll keep you posted on that. Next, we hear from Gary, who writes, Dr. Dave, I was surprised to not hear my name in your most recent roll call of Shrink Wrap Radio donations. So I checked my records. Sure enough, I let the renewal slip my mind. I just set up another year of monthly $10 donations and put a reminder on my calendar so I don't forget next year. Still my number one favorite podcast. Keep it going. Thanks. And that's from Gary Graham. I want to give his full name so that he gets complete recognition and credit here. And Gary, thanks so much for doing that. I really appreciate it. You've been a longtime supporter. And unfortunately, PayPal doesn't give me any kind of notification to know when a person's 12-month term has run out. So people can just kind of drop off the radar in that way. So I hope other listeners will take a cue from you and be equally conscientious. Next is a really special one that I wanted to share with you. It comes from Helen, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. My name is Helen Palomino. I've been a grateful listener for about 2 years and want to help you continue with your wonderful service to anyone who will listen. Your podcasts have enriched me personally and professionally. I'm a medical social worker for the Cancer Resource Center of the Desert, a small organization in a rural desert community on the U.S.-Mexican border in Southeast California. The little center is dedicated to providing free services to persons diagnosed with cancer. Most of the patients I serve are desperately trying to cope with this devastating diagnosis, are uninsured or underinsured, and they are very challenged in navigating the health system and paying the out-of-pocket costs for their ongoing treatment while experiencing the side effects of their cancer treatment. I have the privilege of providing emotional and financial guidance and support to them, primarily in Spanish. My work allows me a backstage pass to their lives. I'm truly honored to be touched by the strength and courage of the human spirit, which they are so generous to share with me. I help these patients and their families anywhere on the cancer continuum, from initial early stage cancer to the terminal stage, however long that may be, and help them transition with direct guidance, demonstrating tender and effective communication and support during the dying process. Among the many podcasts that have brought me so much edification, I truly enjoyed your interview with Rocco Bellick. His experience and inspiration from encountering people who are in the midst of great suffering, and to his surprise, the discovery of happiness within them, resonates with me, as I too have experienced such beauty and am also very fulfilled and happy with my life. Thank you, Dr. Dave, for your commitment to the work you do. I've been encouraged, taught, and inspired by your work, which has allowed me to grow in my creativity, communication, and effective advocacy in helping people in my community who are suffering with cancer. You make a profound difference in ways you would never imagine. By touching me, you are touching the people I touch every day. This is a long overdue thank you." And that's from Helen Palomino, MSW, Cancer Resource Center of the Desert. And Helen, thank you so much for your support and for taking time to write such a soulful note. It's a wonderful work that you're doing. I shared with Helen that one of my sons is, in fact, a cancer survivor who just got his final 5-year clearance. After 5 years, if you're cancer-free, you're considered cured. And so this was a big celebration for us, and my son is becoming a nurse and is going on his way to be a family medicine practitioner as a result of his experiences. And it means a lot to me, Helen, to realize, to have you point out that by touching you and other listeners who you touch, this work is getting extended in helpful ways out further than I am aware. Finally, here's one more from Brad, who writes, "Dr. Dave, you are welcome." I thanked him for his donation. He said, "I only wish I could afford to do more. I have enjoyed your podcasts for years, and I echo the many positive comments from other listeners. I really appreciate the time and energy you devote to producing such interesting content. It adds richness to my morning walks through our local cemetery, which is the time and place I listen to them. The specific prompt to make this donation was your pitch following the keynote address by Dr. Seligman at the World Forum on Positive Psychology. You said you were fired up and it came through. I was also inspired listening to Dr. Seligman. I was in grad school working on my degree in counseling 10 years ago when I first became aware of his strategy of using the tools of psychology to boost clients from 0 to 1 instead of the traditional approach of trying to help people rise from -1 to 0. I was immediately drawn to the concept, though I must admit I've been waiting a bit to see if it would take off. If the attendance at the conference you attended is any indication, it appears it has acquired credibility. I will be interested to hear further results from its use in the U.S. military, but I also think the time has come for me to begin to incorporate its ideas into my work. Thanks again, Dr. Dave. I've told many others about your podcast, and they've all come to enjoy it as much as I have. May God bless you in your continued work, Brad. Well, I do feel so blessed. What wonderful listeners I do have. And I've run on long here, so I won't comment further. That's going to have to wrap it up for today. As always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails for me on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, or on my phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to my good friend and colleague, Dr. Maria Hess, for sharing her Zurich adventure in sand play therapy with us. I'm still not sure if I can snag Dr. Richard Davidson for next episode or not. If it's not him, I've got a good alternate in the queue ready to go. We'll let it be a surprise. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.